Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Normally, I would give many different health and nutrition topics, but today I'm going to spend more time focusing upon two major areas that involve millions, hundreds of millions of people. One is that the government now wants, along with big pharma, they want to screen us. According to activist post Brandon Turville, quote, new government task force calls for screening every adult and every pregnant woman for depression. Quote, a new recommendation has been released by the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, a government advisory group that is now recommending all adults be routinely screened for depression as part of their health care. The first part of the recommendation suggests that all adults be screened, but singles out pregnant women and new mothers as target population, and it goes on to talk about why. And they've already tried Teen Screen, where they gave a little questionnaire to teenagers to fill out, and some of those teens then were told that they have mental illnesses as defined by the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry, and therefore they have to get help. In fact, in one case, a child was taken from her home, put into a psychiatric institution, kept there for a long period of time, given drugs every day, and her parents didn't get her out for 6 months. The reason? She answered that she didn't like going to parties, so they called that social anxiety disorder, and she liked to keep a neat bedroom, and they called that obsessive compulsive disorder. Clearly, it was just a normal teenager, but they have made normal into a pathology. And what concerns me is this is being done everywhere. And you would think that the people are smart enough to see that they're taking normal life issues and suddenly now saying they're diseases. If no one stands up, they will win. And then one day you will be told, for your interest and the community's interest, we have to do these screenings because you may be the next school shooter, and we can determine that based upon these particular tests that we're going to give you, and then we can get you the help you need. The bottom line, all of this is bogus. It's all a fraud. All of psychiatry, except for talk therapy, is a fraud. There is no science in all of psychiatry. But I don't want you taking my word for that. I'm going to have you listen in a little bit to dozens of board-certified psychiatrists, professors of psychiatry, people within the psychiatric mental health field. I told you I was doing a very important documentary called Manufacturing Madness. I want you to hear what some of the people in the field say on this that you will never see in any of the media. You'll never hear them quoted in any article as a reason why you should not take psychiatric drugs, antidepressants, antipsychotic medication, nor ever give it to your children. I'm going to play only a small audio clip each day so that you can get so much per day. But before that, we're going to take a look at the idea of vaccines, because once again, there's a major campaign underway to get mandatory vaccines, and they're using as their experts people who have conflicts of interest, people who own patents, people who have received tens of millions of dollars for vaccines that they created, people whose vaccines have killed hundreds of babies. Yet these are the experts that sit on the FDA advisory panels, do not recuse themselves, who are invited by the media, who are in all the major media talking about the safety of vaccines. You could take thousands at a time with no adverse effect, but the danger of taking supplements. They're slamming one that actually helps you and has the science to prove it, and I gave over 200,000 reference positions of scientific papers are on PubMed on the benefits of supplements, and I also gave you thousands upon thousands of studies on PubMed of the dangers of the drugs that they're advocating. So we have it kind of backwards. We seem to be right now in a state of cognitive dissonance where we want health. What we're doing is creating disease. We want medicine to heal. What much of medicine does is exacerbate our illnesses, injure us, or kill us. We want something that benefits us, and we're getting something that benefits only those who know how to manipulate the system. I'm going to start by playing a clip. This is a clip that I gave when New York State was just about, with no opposition, none, to pass mandatory flu vaccines in New York State. That would have led, of course, to other mandatory vaccines. We only had 2 days' notice, but over 1,400 members of my audience went up to Albany. We had posters. We brought up three medical doctors, and I was invited in to discuss the issue of the safety of these vaccines with three of the state's top doctors. And I gave them a 110-page report, all from peer-reviewed literature, showing them the lack of efficacy and safety in the flu vaccines that they were advocating. What was of interest is there was not one single doctor from New York State there, and hence we were advocating on their behalf. Now, whether they believed in the safety or efficacy of vaccines was secondary. At least they should have done their homework. Clearly they had not. As a result of this, they then had hearings after the fact, and I was the first there in the morning. No one else was there. I signed in, and the rule is that whoever is first and signs in is the first one that is allowed to testify. And they had a board of physicians from the state that were asking questions. You could, you know, they would ask you questions. They would question, challenge you. Every time a person was told to come and talk, it wasn't me. They intentionally put me as the last person of the day or next last person of the whole day. Everyone had gone. The media had gone. There was only one person who was still there, and I didn't even see them, and some physician who videoed it. What you are going to hear now is the video recording that he gave me of my presentation to this group of medical physicians on why I did not believe that mandatory vaccines that have not been tested by any gold standard should be used. I gave each one of them 110 pages. 110 pages is an awful lot of references to bring them a sense of caution. I want to play, the clip is in three stages. I'm only playing 10 minutes of clip one today. Here's the testimony at the New York State hearings on vaccine safety.
Four separate pieces of the puzzle together. Some of it may include some of what you've already heard, but I know for a fact much of it is different. There's an old Jewish saying, a half truth is a full lie. I begin my discussion by asking two basic questions. Are vaccines safe? If so, what is the proof? Are vaccines effective? If so, what is the proof? I am not talking about all vaccines, though this applies to all vaccines specifically on what we're dealing with. I have reviewed the scientific literature extensively. I have spent the last 7.5 years with thousands of hours of research on the subject of autism and what connections they may have to environmental factors, including vaccines. Not just the thimerosal in vaccines, but the other ingredients as well. I produced an award-winning documentary called Autism Made in the USA. I produced a separate documentary called Vaccine Nation, representing all sides. All but the primary sponsor in the United States, vaccines in general, is in there and has his say. I then did something that I thought had been done, and I was surprised when I realized it had not. When I began to review what amounted to thousands of peer-reviewed literature studies on vaccines, I found that I could find no convincing evidence that any vaccine at all had long-term double-blind placebo-controlled study trials, and even when they said, when the evidence I did examine that the CDC and the FDA and other organizations were using as, oh, of course they're studies, and they showed the studies, they would say, well, this is a study, and then I would find that, well, you left out the virus part of the vaccine, but you included all the other ingredients, including thimerosal and mercury and formaldehyde, etc. Well, that's not a placebo. And in good science, you don't use that as a placebo. I also saw that virtually all the studies that were supporting the vaccines were done by the vaccine manufacturers. And since the FDA does not do independent studies on the creation, safety, and efficacy of vaccines, but rather relies upon the information from the vaccine manufacturers, and there's a very close relationship, I then took a very careful look at this relationship and found that more than 50% of people sitting on the FDA and the CDC's vaccine advisory program were from vaccine manufacturers. I felt this was a gross conflict of interest. The rationale was given that there are not enough experts who are independent to sit on these committees. Now, I thought that's absurd. There are more than 3 million outstanding scientists in the United States. Don't tell me you can't find 15 who have no industry affiliation to sit on a vaccine scheduling committee. I then took a careful look, and here's what I found. And this is where you have to bring the pieces together or you lose sight. We're too close, too narrow on this issue. First, when a child is given a vaccine, adults given a vaccine, a senior citizen is given a vaccine, rarely, if ever, has anyone done any study that I can find, and I'm open to the fact I may not have found one that was done, but I looked at thousands, where they looked at combinations of vaccine used in the given individual to see what short and long-term impact it might have had. Now, the panel before said that only 2% of vaccine adverse reactions are reported. The highest number I could find was the FDA's 10%. When you consider that $1.3 billion has been given out in vaccine damage, and you consider that the criteria for receiving that award is based upon getting the proof that your vaccine injury occurred in a very narrow frame of time, and then you look at the epidemiological evidence, you talk with immunologists, you talk with people, and every specialty of medicine, they will tell you many people will have a delayed reaction to a vaccine. It might be a month, 6 months, a year, even 2 years. For 18 years, sir, I have been trying to help the Gulf War veterans in the United States do something that I'm appalled to say that our own federal agencies has failed to do, including Bush Sr., Clinton, and Bush Jr. administrations. Acknowledge that 400,000 GIs who are sick with Gulf War syndrome actually have something other than post-traumatic stress disorder. I've done 3 award-winning documentaries on their plight. I've interviewed over 1,000 of them. I've interviewed people who have massive body lesions, who have rare and exotic diseases, who have brain and neurological disorders, having nothing to do with post-traumatic, didn't even go to the Gulf Theater. They got the vaccines, the experimental anthrax vaccine, the experimental botulism vaccine, that the FDA, similar to what it's doing with swine flu, gave a pass, an exemption on long-term studies. Those Americans, those brave, courageous Americans, over 33,000 are reported dead. Their statistics appear nowhere, only by those who are Gulf War veterans putting together their own figures. They have gone to Washington. I've gone to Washington to interview Chris Todd. I've gone to Washington to interview the people in the presence of the Gulf War vet, a man who got out of bed in the morning, had to crawl to get to his daughter because his legs were swollen the size of a football. A woman who had no illnesses, 22 years old, was in the Gulf, that got the vaccines, and now couldn't walk in bed 16, 18 hours a day. The government has refused to acknowledge that Gulf War syndrome is legitimate. To this day. Now, I've read the hearings, and I saw all of those white coat phenomena, the scientists and physicians that we bow down to, marching in and giving testimony. I had every word they said at every committee hearing. Rockefeller Committee, all of them, and they all were in gross denial. Whose interests were they serving? Certainly not the sick Gulf vets. And you would see the Gulf West determined to get their story out. No one listening. No one has looked at the facts. There are 44 separate studies, 44 today, that showed that Gulf War syndrome is real and that it was due to what they were exposed to. These are real diseases for a decade, and more, they said there's no diseases. Now, I'm wanting to ask, you're willing to inject pregnant women in this state or fire them if they don't take the vaccine. Are you or any member here, anyone, is the governor, is anyone in the state going to be held personally and legally responsible if that developing fetus gets that mercury into their brain and ends up with a learning disability, with autism, with any one of the autism spectrum disorders or ends up with some form of intellectual deficit. We have an epidemic. I did another award-winning documentary called The Drugging of Our Children. Appalling to know that when you were going to school, when I was going to school, no kid got drugged. Today, 10 million American children don't go to school before they get a class 2 drug, the same class as cocaine. Do we actually have a new epidemic that didn't happen to any generation in American history, anywhere else in the world, but suddenly happened in the last 25 years to the newest generation? They have a brain chemical imbalance? No. And yet the so-called experts, the very experts that you would rely upon, are saying, well, must be something wrong. That's why we're giving them the drugs must work. And I say, no. The number one cause of death in the United States in 10 to 14-year-old boys is suicide. How many kids committed suicide when you were going to school, sir? None when I went to school. And I went to the largest high school in my state, 5,500 students, Park Creek High School. So what do we have? A whole new generation of people where autism is suddenly showing its head but never before? If autism were historically there, then everyone in their 50s, 60s, and 70s would start representing, at least percentage-wise, population autism in adults. We don't see it. It doesn't exist. And yet we refuse to acknowledge that what they're getting early in life could be contributing to it. So I'm saying, I'm not willing to step by quietly and allow women who've been used and abused by the medical authorities, the very same medical doctors who have sit here with great certainty and enormous hubris and contempt for women, say, your body is our concern, your developing fetus is in our best interest to make sure it's born healthy, and yet give them mercury. You ask that same doctor, would you give that woman lead? Would you give anyone in this room lead? If you did, you would go to jail. So you're going to give something more toxic than lead to every one of these pregnant women? Sir, I am appalled and I am offended in the extreme, and I will not contain my concern, because these same women that we're so-called interested in, for the last 35 years, I've been one of the leading people advocating against synthetic hormone replacement therapy. We know now it causes breast cancer, ovarian cancer, heart attacks, dementia, and stroke. 10% minimum, 13% more likely. You're talking about 10 million women. That's 1.3 million women we're allowing to be sacrificed on the altar of ignorance or greed or hubris. My mother died of a heart attack in the middle of the night, and she was taking synthetic hormone replacement therapy. Now, another part of this scenario is the number one cause of death in the United States is American medicine. I did a report that has not been refuted with five other MD board certified and PhDs called Death by Medicine. I was intrigued when the American Medical Association said that the number three or four causes of death in the United States was iatrogenesis.
That was just part one of my testimony before this group of physicians representing the state. And keep in mind, there's an opportunity for them to challenge me on any statement. That's normally what happens. If you've seen statements, you come in, you make your statement, and then they just tear you to pieces, or they try to. Not so much this time, because I was just getting into stride. It got a lot more intense, as you will hear on the next program or two, where I was there to defend the rights of physicians, nurses, and everyone else not to have mandatory flu vaccines get mercury, four shots. That's 100 micrograms of mercury. And I didn't even get yet to the statement of what will happen when that gets into your brain. So for those of you around the United States, currently in Virginia and in New York State, where they're trying to get mandatory vaccines and where ALEC is behind the scenes, the American Legislative Exchange Council, where they were able to do this in California, and where I was barred in one of the most gross and contemptible stages of broadcast McCarthyism from KPFA in California, from being able to take the argument with Bonnie Faulkner of Guns and Butter Producer and give a one-hour broadcast to the citizens of California, giving the same information, even more relevant and current information, to help them know why they should fight the vaccine bill. And we were prevented from doing that, hence our voices did not get out, only the pro-vaccine voices. This time, there was no one censoring on free speech radio, no less, my voice. And the people I'm looking in the eyes are a whole panel of physicians. Now you have to wait and hear how they responded and how I responded back to them. And needless to say, I do not bluff and I do not back down from authority figures. I let the facts speak for themselves. Use that video in its entirety at any hearing. If you wish me to come and to testify on behalf of the citizens who oppose mandatory vaccines, I will do so on my own time and my own dime, because we have the science. We have the science that can refute them on everyone. Now, let me go to another segment here, and this deals with psychiatry. Psychiatry is not a scientific profession. At its best, in the hands of individuals who are willing to sit with you and through patience and through their own unique insights and training, be able to elicit from you some of the underlying causes of your emotional dilemma and then help you work together to have better ways of dealing with the problems, to bring them to closure, to allow you to live without rage or anger or resentment or hostility or acting out, then I support it. But I do not support at all the current model of psychiatry that is virtually dominant in the field, nor general practitioners who are using psychotropic drugs on their patients. And as I said, they now want to screen every adult. Could you imagine how many people would end up saying something on a simple screening test that would then mean that they are then, well, they're then considered, you have a mental problem, you have a brain chemical imbalance, but the good news is we can now treat that so you can continue being a productive member of society. We'll hear from that in a moment. One more thing, this is from Timothy Alexander Guzman from Silent Crow News. Big pharma and big profits, the multi-billion dollar vaccine market. Quote, the business of vaccine is soon to become a major source of profits for the world's largest pharmaceutical corporations. A press release from Business Wire, published in MarketWatch, says that Technovo, one of the leading technology research and advisory companies in the world, predicts that pharmaceutical companies who produce vaccines will reach $61 billion in profits. That's huge. Now, mind you, so do we need their vaccines? Should we not encourage people to understand the importance of a healthy lifestyle and natural vaccination? Can they show us which of their vaccines have been tested by a placebo and shown to be effective? Can they show us the long-term multi-vaccine studies? No, they cannot. They do not exist. Well, if you do not have the proof of the safety and efficacy of something, anything, then why would you make it mandatory? Because $61 billion a year, that's a lot of profit, and there's no liability, and there's no downside. Now on to the subject of psychiatry. And this is from Dr. Gary Coles, medical doctor. 14 lies that our psychiatry professors in medical school taught us. One, and I'll go right through them. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, tests all new psychiatric drugs. No, they don't test any. Myth two, FDA approves, approval means that a psychiatric drug is effective long term. No, false also. Most psychiatric drugs are only tested for about 4 to 6 weeks. Myth three, FDA approval means that a psychotropic drug is effective long term. No, just said, they don't do long term. Myth four, mental illnesses are caused by brain chemical imbalances. No. Nowhere in science, anywhere in the world, have they ever had a single study to measure brain chemical imbalances and the psychiatric diagnosis. None. Zip. Zero. And who says that? Who says that? Well, in a moment, if time permits, you won't be able to see it, but you'll hear some people saying, there's none. There's none. These are psychiatrists coming out of the World Congress on Psychiatry and being asked a question. Is there any scientific tool, diagnostic, measurement, to prove that a person has a mental illness of any kind? And every single one says no. Then look at the follow-up question. Then why are you treating them with these dangerous drugs that could kill them? And then you'll be amazed at the response. So you're hearing all these psychiatrists, but you're also going to hear some psychiatrists who found the truth and have changed. Myth, next myth. Well, antidepressants works like insulin for diabetes. No, they do not. There is no need for any psychiatric drug, and it does nothing to help our metabolism as insulin does. SSRIs, that's selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, discontinuance syndromes are different than withdrawal symptoms. No, they are not. And once you're on many of these drugs, you can never get off without major crisis. Ritalin is safe for children or adults. No, it is not. You'll hear parents in this film talk about how their normal kid, completely normal kid, it was suggested that maybe Johnny should pay more attention. If he was on Ritalin, that would be good. Johnny hung himself. Susan poisoned herself. Real kids, real stories. Psychoactive drugs are totally safe for humans. There's never been a study showing that they're safe. Mental illnesses have no known causes. No. Normal life happens. And if someone goes through a period of life where they're dealing with issues and they feel sad, that does not mean they have a brain chemical imbalance. That just means they're feeling sad. And that's not a form of clinical depression. So now I want you to hear. If our engineers, I'm out on the road, so if our engineers have up the... Let me just see here if we've got it. The psychiatric documentary. I'd like for people to hear maybe 10, 15 minutes. Again, I'm going to be playing you segments over the next month, a few a week. You'll get the message. Listen in, please.
Have you been diagnosed with depression and struggle with sadness?
Maybe you're scared of being criticized.
Loss of interest, aches and pain.
I'm always thinking something terrible.
Ask your doctor about Effexor.
Ask your doctor about Cymbalta.
Talk to your doctor about Zoloft.
Talk to your healthcare professional.
Get your doctor today.
Your doctor.
Tell your doctor.
Contact your doctor immediately. Doctor.
Talk with your doctor.
Over 40 years ago, leading psychiatrists met in Puerto Rico to map out their vision of the future.
We see a developing potential for nearly a total control of human emotional status, mental functioning, and will to act.
Their plan? To create by the year 2000 a range of psychiatric drugs regulating every aspect of human behavior.
I was diagnosed with depression and put on Paxil.
ADD. And I was prescribed Ritalin.
General anxiety disorder. Prescribed Zoloft.
Bipolar disorder, and I take lithium.
PTSD, Zoloft.
I was on Paxil.
And they placed me on Zoloft.
They gave me Adderall.
I was prescribed Siptimu.
Tegretol.
Lexapro. Debaco.
Stelazine. Adderall.
Concerta. Lorazine.
Prozac.
Lorazepam.
Effexor.
Clonazepam.
Ritalin.
Dexamphetamine.
Paxil.
Xylert.
Prozac.
Adderall. Elavil.
Debaco. Wellbutrin. Seroquel. Etc.
100 million people worldwide are on psychiatric drugs. How did this happen? Psychiatrists convinced them they were sick.
They want you to think you're diseased from birth, and that all those experiences of life, childhood and adolescence and teenage years and adulthood and being a senior citizen, that these are all various stages of disease.
Because let's face it, we've all been depressed at one time. We've all been anxious at one time. These are normal emotions that we feel.
Every emotional and spiritual problem is reduced to a label.
And of course, all of those diseases require pharmaceutical treatments. This is big, big business.
While generating a healthy income, claiming to be medical professionals, psychiatrists will freely confess that their profession is devoid of science.
We don't really have any specific blood tests or other tests that are definitive for any mental illness whatsoever.
It would be neat if it would become much more scientific.
Well, if you go to my office and you tell me that you're depressed, there's nothing, and no blood sample, whatever, no tests.
There are not current available tests to verify your diagnosis.
I don't use any tests.
You do not have a test to say, well, this is this disorder, and this is the best medication for this disorder.
For many years, we thought we had the tests nailed down, but it turned out that they weren't of any value.
If you don't know what's causing the symptoms, then to give somebody something to alleviate the symptoms is close to impossible.
By the time a drug's approved and it hits the general population, we don't know even 50% of the side effects that are involved with that drug.
And these pills cause heart attacks and liver problems and immune system problems and lots of other medical problems. So you're playing with fire.
Every day, psychotropic drugs cause serious adverse reactions. And while psychiatrists and drug companies fully understand the dangers of the drugs they sell, their unsuspecting customers are left to suffer the consequences.
Everything became worse. Each mood swing was worse.
He would have chronic headaches, chronic, nausea, not feeling good.
She was very agitated, very, very jumpy.
She was having horrible hallucinations.
Her personality was disintegrating.
Once he started on that drug, the cloud just stayed over him and stayed over him and stayed over him. It got darker and darker.
He thought there wasn't anything worth living to kill himself. That was not Matthew. That was the drugs.
At least I would like to have said, I love you. I didn't get a chance to do that.
In addition to crippling scores of people daily, every month, psychiatric drugs kill an estimated 3,000. But the human devastation would never have gotten this high if psychiatrists hadn't worked hand-in-hand with drug companies to promote their drugs to doctors throughout the world. Today, 70% of all psychiatric drugs are prescribed by general physicians. And how was this accomplished? Marketing.
It's about creating a good story that uses science, that convinces a physician to think about writing a prescription.
This is not science. This is incredibly effective marketing. It has nothing to do with science.
They use what I call statistical contortionism. Basically just skew the numbers, make everything look fantastic. You hide the bad numbers.
They're learning every trick in the book. They're evolving into efficient marketing machines. And it's working.
There's definitely an unholy alliance between psychiatry and pharmaceutical sales. That's a marriage made in heaven.
They're like conjoined twins. They're joined at the wallet.
And with 374 mental disorders filling psychiatry's diagnostic manual and more on the way, business is booming. Pharmaceutical companies have expanded their roster of psychotropic drugs from 44 in 1966 to 174 today. The top five psychotropic drugs combined gross more money than the gross national product of each of over half the countries on Earth. Altogether, the psychiatric industry rakes in a third of $1 trillion a year. How could this have happened? It's a tale of deception that may be difficult to believe, but fatal to ignore.
We took him to a psychiatrist, and within a matter of minutes, she's ADHD, and here's your drug.
Went on the Medicaid, and 5 minutes later, he was on Zyprexa.
He saw the psychiatrist and prescribed the medicine for 20 minutes.
The guy didn't even look at her. He talked to her a little bit. Now, how can you tell if somebody's ADHD or not ADHD from just a few minutes talking to her?
Next thing I know, I'm getting handed a handful of Xanax. That's how easy it is to get these drugs. Just so easy. It was just passed to me like candy. That simple.
If a person were to walk in off the street, sat down with a psychiatrist, the chances of him being prescribed a drug before he were to leave the office, I would have to put it at 100%.
Psychiatrists prescribe drugs. They might have different ways of diagnosing, they might have different ways of interacting with a patient, but it's rare to find a psychiatrist that uses no drugs.
The psychiatrists today are, in quotes, admitting they can't cure
these mental illnesses, and they're therefore going to manage your illness by using a drug.
50 years ago, a person who was going through a divorce would have relied on family, friends, clergy, and even the family doctor to a certain extent for conversation to work through the issue. They certainly wouldn't have been medicated.
That was before the era of psychotropic drugs. Psychiatrists, occupying the lowest rung of the medical profession, worked almost exclusively in mental institutions. With no cures, there was little chance they would ever be respected by the public and their peers as real doctors.
Psychiatrists had for years been on the fringe of medicine. Typically, the standard doctor internist would have very low regard for psychiatrists because it was understood not to be a very clear science or art.
Psychiatrists wanted to be viewed as physicians, as doctors. And in order to be viewed as physicians and doctors, the people they dealt with had to be viewed as patients. And if doctors dealt with diseases, then their patients had to be diseased.
Psychiatrists had a wonderful opportunity, they felt, to become respected in the eyes of their peers. They raced to create a whole diagnostic book called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which was created by consensus.
A group of psychologists and psychiatrists get together, and if they have made common observations, they have a vote and they now classify a new disease. And they give it a number and it graduates into the DSM classification.
And it's a dangerous book. It's a book that has many disorders that could apply to any one of us, because the disorders are not real medical diseases. And it's things that apply to nearly all of us at times. Are you afraid of meeting new people? Are you afraid to speak in front of a large crowd of people? Does it make you nervous to go and to talk to your boss about a complaint?
You can invent a mental disorder based on a checklist of symptoms, and that is exactly how the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the billing Bible for psychiatry, works.
Since the DSM's first edition in 1952, the number of diagnoses has steadily grown. From a slender 130-page booklet listing 106 so-called mental disorders, the DSM has bloated to a voluminous 886 pages. It is only through the use of this book that psychiatrists can diagnose, drug, and bill for services. In fact, the psychiatric industry currently uses the DSM to collect over $72 billion in private and government insurance money.
The DSM is used to diagnose and then give a label, and the label is used for billing purposes. That's how they get paid.
You have to have a term in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual in order to then call it a disease and treat it as a disease and write a prescription for it.
And so because they can vote it in, they can create, and then the drug industry can just take over and market their drugs for those new disorders.
And those drugs were welcomed by psychiatry leaders because it made us real doctors.
Of course, first the public had to believe that there was something wrong with them, and that that thing wrong was biochemical, and that that could then be treated by a drug which was supposed to cure all.
And so it was relatively easy, I think, to say, well, look, let's start looking at mental illness as fundamentally a matter of chemical imbalance in the brain.
Chemical imbalance is a term that's used.
That was just a small insight into psychiatry and how you end up being diagnosed with a condition that simply does not exist. They're now even treating more than 250,000 babies and toddlers each year with psychoactive drugs. Considering that these are capable of altering brain chemistry, could you imagine what's going to happen to those kids as they start to grow? And yet it's profitable. And as long as it's profitable, and as long as they control the legislation, and as long as the courts acknowledge that they're the so-called authorities on what is normal and not normal behavior, then they win. Unless they're exposed. Unless we the people know the truth. And time and time again, their so-called truths end up being lies. Now it's time for TalkBack, your opportunity to call in on either the issue of vaccines being mandatory across the United States, where you have no choice, not a religious choice, not a philosophical choice. You're told to take these vaccines, even though there are no science behind them, independent, legitimate science showing they're safe or effective. And also the whole idea that now they want to test everyone in America, every adult, for depression. And that means that they can convince you that you have a mental illness. That's why they went direct to the consumer in advertising. There's only two nations on the planet, New Zealand and America, that allow that because they know how susceptible people are. Do you feel tense in a crowd? Do you feel as if you need to be alone? Well, then you need this drug. Call your doctor. Call your doctor. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888 is our TalkBack number. I'd like to hear your input, your thoughts. Please give a call. And we're going to take a brief break and come back and see who's on the line. And I have a lot more to share with you. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. Now I'm going to take a look at some other issues that are important, that are not getting the attention I believe that they deserve. First up is the TTIP, that's a new treaty, enters new and dangerous stage as democracy is dismantled in secret. This is from Graham Van Bergen of TruePublica. The TTIP negotiations continue in the shadows in both America and the European Union, and they enter a new and dangerous stage as existing legal barriers that would inhibit certain types of harmful trade are dismantled in favor of a new set of rules termed regulatory cooperation. It sounds collaborative. It is, but just not with the public interest. What is really meaning is that decades of regulations passed by governments legislated upon for public interest and safety reasons are being swept aside. These new regulations that the public and journalists are barred from being a party to include the demolition of environmental protections, safety at work regulations, food safety, and other laws designed to protect and defend public safety. Any new regulation that the European Union states would want to impose in future are now facing considerable barriers and hurdles that could take years to negotiate, and the system is clearly being designed to be onerous and just plain difficult to favor corporate interests above public interest. The Corporate Observatory, whose specialty is exposing the power of corporate lobbying in the European Union, has recently published its latest report, Dangerous Regulatory Duet, which exposes how a new framework being implemented under regulatory cooperation through the TTIP will allow bureaucrats and big business to attack the public interest. The report highlights some examples of how big business and the governments of America and the European Union have conspired to destroy those safeguards. And then it goes into detail on all the different ways that you and I would no longer have anything that would protect us from anything. And that's being done by our government and the leading business authorities in our country. I mentioned this the other day. I mentioned the title. Let me get me just a little bit on this. This is from our environmental segment from Common Dreams. Stuck on the brink, doomsday clock leaves humanity 3 minutes to midnight. And why is that important? The doomsday clock represents how close we are to destroying our civilization with dangerous technologies of our own making. Quote, with utter dismay, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists announced this week that the symbiotic doomsday clock will hold at 3 minutes to midnight at the brink of man-made apocalypse because world leaders have failed to take the necessary steps to protect citizens from the grave threats of nuclear war and runaway climate change. Quote, 3 minutes to midnight is too close, far too close. And that's according to the Bulletin of Science and Security Board. The decision not to move the hands of the doomsday clock is not good news, it continues, but an expression of dismay that world leaders continue to fail to focus their efforts on the world's attention on reducing the extreme danger posed by nuclear weapons and climate change. We will call these dangers existential. That is exactly what we mean. They threaten the very existence of civilization and therefore should be the first order of business for leaders who care about their constituents and their countries. And the Bulletin Science and Security Board has 17 Nobel laureates on its panel. So they're very concerned. They see that we're entering a new stage where because the governments have chosen not to do anything that would really make a difference and businesses are not going to change, and we are not going to change our patterns of purchasing and consuming. We could, but we're not. That we're going to go through some cataclysmic events. Some people will be impacted, others won't, depending upon where in the world you're at and the resources you have. So I'll just keep sharing the information and why we should pay attention. It's up to each of us to become vegan. It's up to each of us to stop buying stuff we don't need, stop buying plastics, stop polluting. Even if you chose to not fly one time a year that you would otherwise fly. In other words, if you were going to go on a vacation, just make your vacation local. Make it in your state. That would make a big difference. So little things you can do individually can make a difference. For those of you in California, Dan Botcher of Nation of Change says, better pay attention. All of your fish, all of them, are plummeting. Quote, fish species ranging from endangered Delta smelt to striped bass continue to plummet to record low population levels in 2015 in the Sacramento-San Waukegan River Delta, according to the annual fall survey of the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Only six Delta smelt, an endangered species that once numbered into the millions and was the most abundant fish in the Delta, were collected. So you went from millions to just six. And that's just one of many fish that are dying. And it's because of development and climate change. All I have to do is raise the temperature too much, and some species simply cannot survive. Now, this is from Dar Jamel from Truth Out, and it's something we definitely need to pay attention to, and that is Fukushima. The article is entitled Radioactive Water from Fukushima is Leaking into the Pacific. Fukushima is the biggest industrial catastrophe in the history of mankind, so says Arnold Gunderson, a former nuclear industry senior vice president, told Truth Out after a 9.0 earthquake in Japan caused a tsunami that destroyed the cooling system of Tokyo Electric Power Company's nuclear plant in Fukushima, Japan. And while this statement might sound overdramatic, Gunderson may be right. Several nuclear reactor meltdowns in the plant, which at the time forced the mandatory evacuation of thousands of people living within a 15-mile radius of the damaged power plant, persist. And experts like Gunderson continue to warn that this problem is not going away. And in fact, in March of 11th of 2011, 5 years ago, the 9.0 earthquake that destroyed the cooling systems at TEPCO led to hydrogen explosions and reactor meltdowns and has left exposed highly radioactive materials that Gunderson says are the root of the problem. For now, There is no solution in sight. Quote, Fukushima has three nuclear reactors exposed and four fuel cores exposed. You probably have the equivalent of 20 nuclear reactor cores because the fuel cores, and they are all in desperate need of being cooled, and there is no means to cool them effectively. End quote. Well, this persistent problem reared its head again just last month, when TEPCO was forced to deal with a massive amount of highly radioactive water generated by having to cool the reactors and expose fuel cores, and TEPCO must now transfer 300 tons of groundwater into highly contaminated reactor buildings, having been unable to devise an effective plan for keeping groundwater from continuing to flow under the plant. Quote, the problem is how to keep it cool. They are pouring in water, and the question is, what are they going to do with the waste that comes out that system, because it's going to contain plutonium and uranium? Where do you put the water? Well, 100,000 gallons going right into the ocean every 24 hours. And that is causing a problem. So you have problems that are not being resolved. And the latest study I just got this morning showed that there's very high levels of radiation all around Tokyo. That's the most populous city in the world with 40 million people, and they've got serious problems. So my suggestion is that the Japanese government invite in all of the top scientists in the world to see about creating something similar to a non-penetrable, maybe combination of titanium and steel sarcophagus. And dig down, bring it underneath, maybe 100 feet under, and then up and around. You've got to encase it, or it won't stop leaking, and it won't stop going into the air. And when that goes in the air, it doesn't die. Some of those isotopes are going to be around when all the life on the planet, as we know it, is long gone. And the people of Japan, you're being exposed at an astronomical rate. Let's say hello to Stephanie from the Bronx. Hi, Stephanie. Your turn.
Hi, Gary. I just first want to thank you. I feel your show has saved my family's health, definitely, and possibly our son's life. And we didn't realize it at the time, but he was vaccine injured from a vaccine he received within 2 days. He was feverish, spotty. I went to the doctor 3 times. They told me this is normal. This could happen. It wound up he had Kawasaki's disease. He was treated with IVIG. They released us from Hackensack Hospital. 6 months later, he was given a MMR vaccine, and he stopped walking. He was totally shut down. He said, I looked at him. I said, I'm taking him to Columbia's ER. So we went into Columbia's ER. They said that we can't, there's nothing wrong. I said, please run a SED rate test on my son. I think he has Kawasaki's disease again. They said, no, he doesn't have the symptoms. Sure enough, he was atypical Kawasaki's disease again. Now, those were the only 2 vaccines my son ever received in his life. And I started questioning what was going on. And then I heard your show, and you mentioned the word Kawasaki on that show, disease. And I started researching and studying, and it's very clear that my son was vaccine injured. We changed our whole life. Since that time, the doctors wanted to put him on medication, anti-psych meds. I said, no. We've done essential oils that we heard of through your show. We've changed our life completely in terms of the water we drink, the food we eat, the places we source our cleaning products from, just everything. And we have seen a turnaround. And I have gone to my other 2 children's vaccine history and looked up. My oldest son is 23 years old. He was given 6 vaccines on 1 day at a Park Avenue Pediatric Center. And within 4 days of that vaccine schedule set, my son had all over eczema that has been with him for 20 years. And it wasn't until doing everything I heard of from your show, my son has been healed. And I want to say we are in the fight for the life of our children and the health of our children. And it's enough toxic death that we're feeding to our kids.
Well, it's never enough profit to satisfy the needs of corporate America. So we must continue to be diligent. We must continue to share information. So thank you very much, Stephanie, for calling in. We have time for one more. Jan from Brooklyn. Your turn, Jan. You're on the air.
Hi. I have two quick questions. The mercury, the amalgam fillings, I once heard that if we had the ADA, we did a bill that we won't be allowed to sue the ADA for the mercury and the amalgams. Maybe then they'll turn around and stop promoting it. And also, you said on one of your programs, I remember, that the CDC, the pharmaceuticals, wanted to take out of the flu vaccine the mercury, and then the CDC said, no, don't take it out. Do you know why?
Well, if you take a toxin out, and if you're able to show that that toxin had negative impact at a neurological level, let's just keep it at the neurological. It also impacts your kidneys, your heart, your eyes, just neurologically. Then think of the millions upon millions of people who could say, well, that possibly led to the adverse physiological conditions, biochemical conditions of my child. You would then open yourself up for massive class action lawsuits. And you would embarrass the government. And the government always considers its reputation and the power it has to maintain an image first and foremost. It never considers, ever, in any circumstance, when it's made a mistake like Tuskegee, when it's done the experiment on people in prison systems, on our armed service personnel, it never considers doing right by them first. It always does right by itself first, so it will not acknowledge something, because to do so would then be to make it culpable. But we did get it out of some of the vaccines, but not all. More importantly, within the next 2 weeks, I'll be doing a 3-hour special on autism. We have experts from all over the world who are going to be contributing insights and information on the various causes of autism. And also, two of the individuals will be talking about documents they have in hand that prove that the scientists at the CDC knew the MMR vaccine caused mental disorders, especially in African-American children, at more than a 227% increase in those under 36 months of age, and they hid it. Not only did they hide it, but they went so far as to meet in one of their offices with black garbage bags to take all their documents and throw them away. That would have been the end of the story. But one of the doctors thought this is wrong and kept a copy. The copies of those documents are now in the hands of a journalist. The journalist will appear on the program and reveal and read from those documents. So then the question is, what can we, the public, do when you can prove a conspiracy by government officials? Because the government employees are protected. You cannot just sue the government, nor an individual in the government. But we have also consulted with lawyers who say, yes, you can, if you can prove that what they did went against their own government's mandates and policies and conspired to do something that was patently illegal or fraudulent. So that is for a team of doctors to handle. You'll hear the truth, and that should set to rest, at least for this audience, all of the evidence necessary to understand why we have an epidemic of autism. Okay? Thank you, Jan, for your call, and for Stephanie for your call. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone.